21st Century Radio is sponsored by Hieronymus & Company. This is Talk Radio 680 WCBM. It's time now for award-winning 21st Century Radio. Here's your host, Dr. Bob Hieronymus.
What would you do if I sang out of tune? Would you stand up and walk out on me? Let me old ears and I'll sing you a song. I will try not to sing out of key. Oh, baby, happy birthday.
Welcome back to 21st Century Radio. I'm Dr. Bob Hieronymus. Our executive producer, research assistant, Laura Corden. Our engineer is Jake Bryant. You know, the premiere of Secrets of the Founding Fathers, our two-hour special, will premiere on the History Channel on Monday, June 29th at 8 p.m., and the Discovery Channel's two-hour production we were involved in, called Secret America, will be repeated in the coming weeks. Now, we're doing a series of specials on Woodstock 1969 because it was a moment in history that proved to myself and millions others that that experience 40 years ago gave us a glimpse and hope of what America and the rest of the planet will become, and that is one people, one planet. Tonight, we will introduce you to the best of many excellent books on the market today honoring the 40th anniversary of Woodstock. The book we're discussing for the first 1.5 hours is Woodstock, Peace, Music, and Memories by Brad Littleproud and Joanna Haig, and published by Krause. Why is it the best of the many excellent books coming out for Woodstock's 40th anniversary? Well, aesthetically, it's gorgeous. It vibrates with the energy that is aesthetically 1969. It opens the hearts and minds of those who ever wondered about the meaning of Woodstock by illustrating the Woodstock state of mind with the stories of those who produced, attended, or performed at the birthplace of a generation. It is profusely illustrated with personal and professional photos from scores of participants. Woodstock Peace, Music, and Memories perfectly captures the sometimes ugly truth and the magical beauty of this transformative event. Of course, I also love all the mentions and photos of my very own painted VW van, the light bus. Not only is it featured on the cover next to Jimi Hendrix, who coincidentally exchanged his sketchbooks with me while talking about symbolism the same summer that I painted this bus, but they are also the first in print to announce the 2009 release of the 1/12 scale collector's model of the Woodstock bus created by Sunstar Diecast. Now, if you can buy only one Woodstock 40th anniversary commemorative this summer, it should be Littleproud and Haig's. With a long-time interest in the socio-cultural history of the 1960s and a passion for the classic rock music of the era, Brad Littleproud of Toronto, Canada, and Joanna Haig of Blakely, Pennsylvania, were intrigued with the allure surrounding the fabled 1969 Woodstock Festival. They became members of the Woodstock Preservation Alliance, an organization founded to perpetuate the spirit of Woodstock and to preserve the site as an open field where all people would be welcome to celebrate peace, love, and music. And despite the fact that both Littleproud and Haig were too young to have attended the original festival in 1969, they have embraced the mission to preserve the site and experience that is Woodstock. Because of this commitment, the Woodstock site will continue to have some resemblance to its original state for years to come. To learn more about their work, visit Woodstock Preservation Archives, www.woodstockpreservation.org. Welcome to 21st Century Radio, Joanne and Brad.
Thank you, Dr. Bob.
Hi, Dr. Bob. Thank you for having us on.
Well, you're very welcome. Mike Lang, a co-producer of Woodstock, consistently refers to Woodstock as a state of mind, similar to what George Harrison said, it's all in the mind. So what does Mike mean that Woodstock is a state of mind?
Oh, do you want to take that one, Joanne, or should I?
Well, you can start.
Okay. You know, I mean, the thing is that, yeah, that's something that Michael definitely consistently says, and it's true. I do think that a lot of people do see, you know, that event and the aftermath and what it has meant to people really as a sort of a state of mind and as really sort of a coming of age for a generation. That, you know, regardless of where it was held, that, you know, that the actual land itself is more, you know, sort of a transient place. It was a place where it did occur, but it's a place where, you know, I think this is what, you know, I don't want to put words in Michael's mouth, but, you know, that what they took away from the event really kind of lives on in people. And, you know, I think he, you know, I think he is somewhat appreciative of the work that was done and the fact that that site, you know, remarkably still remains in somewhat its original format, you know, that it was, you know, 40 years ago.
Well, he originally called it the Aquarian Festival, and I think, well, actually, it wasn't the Aquarian Festival. Aquarian what? What was that again? Exposition, yeah. And of course, that kind of became less important later on. So, not, and that's an Aquarian vision, a state of mind. I mean, that really fits with that. Joanne, Artie Cornfield, a second co-creator and promoter of Woodstock, who wrote the foreword to your book as the birth of a generation, or the Woodstock generation. What does he mean by Woodstock generation?
Oh, I think we go back to that state of mind. I think it's in fact, all the people that we interviewed for the book, they all live within this place. They're all very giving people. They're all doing something for someone else.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I think that it's kind of just where this all started, and this is what they took away from this event.
Mm-hmm.
And that was really, and a lot of people look at it as the birthplace of the Woodstock Nation, as it's a sacred ground to them.
I see the Don.
Yeah, if you don't mind me, you may piping in there, and I had been just speaking with the campground director Stanley Goldstein last week. He was Woodstock Venture's second employee, and he made an interesting comment to me that really, I mean, that the festival itself, I mean, at a time, and it's even stated in our book, like Don Adder says about it, you know, it was a generation that was, you know, even at odds with its own concept of peace and love, and that, you know, they really sought to produce an event, you know, not in a coliseum, not in an arena, but in an environment that had this promise of peacefulness, and well, that, you know, and it would be something that they would be able to actually feel and would be able to experience, especially at a time where that was something that was kind of hard to grasp at with Vietnam raging and with your leaders being shot down and you know, and so I think that really, as far as trying to create a feel, that's really what Woodstock is about.
Trying to create a feel, yes, exactly.
And I understand also Don Adder's used the term rainbow warriors, which I think that was quite excellent. Now, what do you think, Joanne, what do you think was behind the media's initial attempt to reduce the event to, quote, reckless sex, drugs, and rock and roll, and irresponsible hedonism?
Oh, I think it made for good press. I think it sold a real lot of newspapers. You know, I myself, yeah. I was too young. I was 12. But that's what I can remember.
Mm-hmm.
I can remember seeing the kids sliding in the mud and seeing that on TV. I'm losing my track of my train of thought here. But I think that it was a good press for them, and I think just with everything else that was going on in the newspapers, everything was just feeding everything.
Mm-hmm. Brad, do you want to add anything to that?
Well, definitely. I mean, and you know, we're talking about, you know, a generation. You know, definitely talk about the generation gap. I mean, somewhere between Leave It to Beaver and in the psychedelic era, you know, the you know, the conservative status quo wanting to be maintained during that era, but things were changing. People were questioning. You know, you're talking about no longer a voluntary army, you know, fighting in a war that people are starting to wonder what the heck's going on here. So, yeah, I mean, definitely something was going on that, you know, people were starting to question.
Well, let's hope so. You know, I think questioning authority is the most important thing you could possibly do. It's unfortunate that we've just had in our federal government 8 years of not being able to question any of the authority. I think that's a serious problem when you can't question authority without getting yourself thrown in jail. Elliot Tiber, what important part did he play in the co-creation of Woodstock?
Well, you want to take that, Joanne? You know Elliot.
Oh, Elliot, I think that, you know, he had a really large part in it. He had the permit. And I don't know how far they would have gone without that. And he was the one who stepped up. You know, maybe the land that he was hoping to use wasn't all that going to work for them.
Yeah.
But he introduced, you know, Michael Lang to Max, and things just went from there. So even what little bit of part maybe that he played in it, it was really a big part.
Yes, and as a matter of fact, is the film that's going to be coming out in the next couple. Do you know? Remember the name of the film, Brad?
That's Taking Woodstock.
Taking Woodstock. Is that what it's going to call? Same
that's
as his book.
Yeah, that's what it's being
same
called, based
book.
On his book.
That's a powerful book.
Yeah,
book.
Well, the thing is, too, about that book is that, I mean, that book's been written three times. And what's interesting, and I try to keep up on, you know, all of the. It's interesting when things become topical and relevant the way the 40th anniversary has, you know, made Woodstock topical and relevant again. There's so much in the news, et cetera, and you start trying to piece things together. Well, I mean, it's interesting even after 40 years, you know, how, you know, the main players then start to bicker over what's truth and what's not truth and what is, you know, what is fabrication, et cetera. And I know that even now, you know, you can search in. And people like Michael Lang and Artie Kornfeld, you know, have their issues with how truthful, you know, how the extent to which Elliot was involved beyond, you know, having the permit. And so it's going to be kind of interesting when the movie comes out, you know, that, you know, even after 40 years, there's still this sort of competition as to, okay, now who has the real truthful story behind all of this?
Yeah.
You know, and things must have been so busy right at that time that I think that things maybe were just getting done and, you know, things that maybe you don't even remember, the little steps that were taken, mm-hmm. you know, just between Wallkill and Bethel, they had no time in there.
Yeah, I know. It was either going to happen within a couple of days or wasn't going to happen at all. That was quite a struggle there. Now, two people that I have enormous fondness for are Wavy Gravy, and that's Hugh Romney. Is that his? Yeah, that's his real name now. And he wasn't Wavy Gravy at the festival, actually. He was Hugh Romney.
Yeah,
he didn't get his name until B.B. King gave it to him. Is that right?
That's correct.
Yeah, it's in your book, right?
Yeah.
But, well, it's Wavy Gravy and his wife are extraordinary people in the hog farm. Tell us about the part they played.
Well, I mean, the thing is that, you know, originally, again, Stan Goldstein had, he knew of them. He knew, you know, of their, what they had been trying to do politically, et cetera. And he was from out in California as well. So when Michael Lang had basically said, okay, you know, we were expecting a large group here, you know, and some are going to show up well prepared, most are not going to show up very well prepared. We know there's the possibility of drug use. There we know, you know, people are going to have to be taken care of. The conventional systems are basically really are not going to work very well. And so I think it was Stanley Goldstein who said, you know what, we got this, there's this wonderful group of communal folks out there in New Mexico called the Hog Farm. And really, I think it was Stanley Goldstein got a hold of either Lisa Law or Wavy Gravy himself. Maybe it was Lisa Law. I'm trying to remember what the story was. But regardless, he made those arrangements to say, how many of your folks can come out? I mean, really, all we really want you to be doing is coming out, helping set up the campgrounds, you know, set up some of the kitchens, take care of some of the folks, et cetera. It was, from my understanding, it was a rather, it wasn't highly specific as to what they were supposed to be doing. And the story we have in the book is about they had no idea that the New York State Police, who were supposed to be policing the event, decided they were not going to. And when Ravy Gravy and his crew got off at JFK, he learned from the world press that was waiting to greet them that they were going to be security. And he says to them, "Oh my God, they made us the cops."
Yeah.
And so he turns to the one reporter and says, "Well, do you feel secure?" And the guy says, "I guess." So he goes, "I see, it's already working." He was able to roll with it.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, they became quite an important a crew that was there.
It certainly did. They
know,
fed
feeding
people.
The people, setting up the hospital tents, you name it. They really were the glue that kept it going. I don't think the kids would have survived.
Probably not. Joanne, you had something to say there?
I was just saying that they did a phenomenal job. Just listening and reading as to what they done, I take it as such a personal education, because I've learned so much from what they did in 69.
Mm-hmm.
Just they did a phenomenal job to handle those people, to see that they were fed, and to you know, the helicopters are coming in, they needed to get landing, how they got the people to work together, and the hospital that they set up. So they extraordinary.
Yeah, they certainly were.
And Wavy's wife Janara, when I interviewed her, she, you know, and she doesn't give very many interviews, so I was quite honored that she actually, Wavy does most of the talking. And so when she spoke to me, I was quite honored that she took the time. And she was so humbled, and she said they were humbled. They themselves were humbled about the fact that they walked in, because they were not looked highly upon. Hippies were not, you know, were not highly looked upon. And just the fact that they were so competent and pulled things together, they just surprised themselves. You know,
and
not that they didn't think they could do it.
The confidence. I was so proud of John Harder when you know, she said that, you know, that she got this confidence after the event, you know, and felt better of herself to go on to do other things. And I was just, you know, I'm just so proud that she was in our book and that she told us the story.
Well, right now, we got to take a break, and we'll come back with Brad Littleproud and Joanna Haig. Woodstock, Peace, Music, and Memories. Krause Publications, woodstockpeace.com, 1-800-258-0929.
Easy, you know the way it's supposed to be. Silver on the shoreline, let us be talking about very free and easy.
And a good Sunday. Rich Andre, Beach Traffic. This update is by Geico Insurance. Westbound Bay Bridge, still fairly quiet. Moderate to heavy, we'll say. No delays going back to Anwato County from the Eastern Shore. And we've thinned out fairly nicely traffic-wise on the Eastern Shore in the past hour and a half or so. Still will be a few heavy pockets westbound on 50 and also along 404. Also keep in mind, we've still got the problem with the steel plate on top of the pothole westbound on 50 by the 301 merge. Looks like traffic was still a bit heavy going through there. And watch out, as that will be a bit of a bumpy ride as you go on top of that particular plate. This update by Geico. You could save hundreds with Geico. 1-800-947-AUTO for your free quote. And I'm Richard Andre with Beach Traffic here on Talk Radio 680 WCBM.
Reason number 9 to switch to Geico. There's nothing sweeter than saving money on car insurance. It's one of those rare opportunities in life where you can thumb your nose at the system and say, "Okay, system, listen up. I just got a better deal with Geico. Great savings, personal service 24/7, and the latest in online technology." Of course, the system may sulk for a day or two, but you're going to feel a lot better.
For a free rate quote, visit GEICO.com or call 1-800-947-AUTO. 15 minutes could save you 15%.
If you ride a motorcycle, you might be thinking, oi, GEICO customers seem to be having a lot of fun and saving money on their car insurance. But what about us bikers? Why can't we save money? This makes us angry. Let's form a biker gang and go and tell them what for. Oi, hold on, just call it. GEICO insures all sorts of motorcycles like cruisers, street, sport, touring and high-performance bikes. So they're on it. Now let's have a little smile.
Now GEICO offers insurance on all the stuff that moves you, including motorcycles. Call 1-800-44-CYCLE or visit GEICO.com.
Ryan, technician for SafeLight Auto Glass.
My last customer was really busy with work. Unfortunately, a rock cracked his windshield, and he knew it wasn't safe to drive, so he called SafeLight. I came right to his office and replaced it the very next day. He was thrilled. He could keep working, and it was replaced before he knew it. And thanks to his insurance coverage, he only had to pay his deductible.
Let SafeLight handle the insurance claim for you. Just call 1-800-800-2727.
SafeLight Repair, SafeLight Replace.
When you're really in pain, everything seems to add to it. Relief can't come fast enough. Now there's new Bayer Quick Release Crystals, a whole new form of pain relief from Bayer that dissolves quickly on your tongue. With an extra pain-relieving booster, it's ready to go to work faster than caplets or tablets, which take time to dissolve. So before you know it, you're feeling a whole lot better. New Bayer Quick Release Crystals with a bold citrus taste. Just rip, pour on your tongue, and expect relief fast. Take with water as directed.
The views and opinions of the guests and hosts you hear are not necessarily those of the owners, management, or advertisers of Talk Radio 680. WCBM.
If you're a business owner or executive seeking growth yet determined to cut wasteful costs, consider outsourcing your whole marketing department to The Selling Well. The Selling Well offers businesses truly superior marketing services without all the overhead costs associated with employing a full-time marketing executive. Learn more online at theSellingWell.com. That's theSellingWell.com, named after one of our greatest symbols of prosperity, the well. Visit theSellingWell.com or call The Selling Well's managing partner, Plato Hieronymus, at 443-939-1890. TheSellingWell.com. Researchers at Johns Hopkins are seeking volunteers with a diagnosis of cancer to participate in a scientific study of self-exploration brought about by psilocybin. Psilocybin is a psychoactive substance found naturally in mushrooms, which has been used for centuries as a sacrament for religious and spiritual purposes. Volunteers will be given careful preparation before receiving the psilocybin in a comfortable, supportive setting. Structured guidance both during and after the session will facilitate integration. This study complies with all FDA regulations. Please call 410-550-5990 or visit cancer-insight.org. Confidentiality will be maintained. That's 410-550-5990 or www.cancer-insight.org.
Hi, this is Elliot Landy, and I've taken a lot of photographs in my life, many of which have just been published in a book called Woodstock Vision, The Spirit of a Generation. And this is 21st Century Radio, and you're listening to Dr. Bob Hieronymus.
Welcome back to 21st Century Radio with our guests Brad Littleproud and Joanne Haig. Woodstock Peace, Music and Memories, Krause Publications, WoodstockPeace.com, 1-800-258-0929. There goes Sly in a Family Stone. He was some character, I'll tell you. All right, well, the book is filled with numerous memories of regular folks to the VIPs who co-created and played at the event. Randy Sheets, in particular, made important contributions because his dad loaned him his 8mm camera. What kind of images did Brother Randy capture?
Oh, wow. You want to start there, Joanne?
You took care of the film, but still, the book is done, and I can't believe that this kid made it through the weekend of the weather and made it home with that camera and that film.
Yep, yeah.
To me, that's amazing. But
yeah, and it was those types of those images that have been so. I mean, I think what makes our book so unique and as, you know, apart from a lot of the other books that have either been put out on Woodstock or are currently out on Woodstock, is that, you know, you not only do you get to read about, you know, and go through the actual event and relive the event through the eyes of the folks that were there, but you actually get to see from their vantage point. And yeah, I mean, when Joanne sent me Randy's film, we weren't too quite sure how we were going to do this, and I knew a fellow up here in Toronto who John Lovell, who has a he's a professional
filmologist.
He's able to take 8mm film, any type of film, and he cleans it up and he digitizes it. And so, you know, he was able to take this film. He was able to clean it. I mean, we're talking a 40-year-old film, and it had hair, and it had you name it. It had been through the wars. And we were able to extract some just amazing images of, you know, of the kids that had gone. I mean, Randy and his friends, you know, their actual trip. You know, there's a picture of the Garden State Parkway there, you know, that they had taken.
Right.
And and as well when they got there, you know, so many images of people riding on the backs of vehicles through the back farm roads, hitching rides, then at the festival itself. It was just wonderful. It was a painstaking operation, I'll tell you that. I mean, having this film that had been put into digital format and then going through frame by frame to find the best images that we could. And, you know, there were some great pictures of things that I didn't, you know, at first glance never even noticed. But then when I slowed it down, you know, noticed that they were actually, it was the hog farm compound, and you could see the Merry Pranksters bus further in the background.
Yeah, there's
a
close-up.
Capture that.
Yeah, there's a close-up of the front of that bus. I'm so glad they got that. Really focused in on that, because you seldom see any photos in regards to that. Now, Joanne, there, 23-year-old Alan Futrell, I guess that's how you pronounce it, of Sanford, Florida, an ex-military, learned something about his backpack at Woodstock. What was it?
He learned that he could put it down anywhere and nobody touch it. That was what he noticed most about Woodstock, was that everybody respected everybody's spot, their personal belongings, and that he could leave his backpack and walk through the crowd for the whole day, go back. And I believe that he was staying up by the buses, because the buses, I believe that I'm correct, I believe that the buses was... they inspired him, and he took still, I believe he still has a bus, but the buses fascinated him, and he could always go back, and nothing would be touched. Everybody else's belongings.
You know, that's the way it used to be, according to my father, back in the 40s at certain times. People left, you know, there was that kind of thing happening. And I think Woodstock was really showed that their interest in physical, personal things was not the key to this event. It had to do with what was inside of us. Now, I'm particularly thrilled with this book because the bust that I painted for Bob Grimm and his group Light is found on the cover and all throughout the entire book. And also... the light bus can be seen in partial shots in other books, but this is the only book that actually shows all sides of it. And also, the most important thing to me is that it actually identified the people that sat on top of that bus. Nobody.
Oh, it told the story.
Yeah.
It told the story of that bus there, and it told the story of the people who were there with that bus.
And that's really important from... especially Trudy and Bob Grimm, who are also throughout this work. Trudy had a lot of interesting comments.
Yes, she did.
Being musicians, you know, you could tell how what they were thinking about. She was overwhelmed, overawed, and in many different ways. We're not going to talk about the porta pots, which you discussed. But that must have really been something altogether. And thanks also for putting the diecast model on that. It is the only book that has done that. And that is really important to me personally, but also to others who I'm, you know, we're getting a lot of calls. When can you get it? And that kind of thing. Now, while we're on Trudy Morgel right here, who was the drummer and singer in the Light Band, and whose photograph atop the light bus has probably been printed in most major papers across the country. I know it's also been used a lot in Europe. She tells a story about how she went out to get a jug filled with water.
Oh, yes.
But returned empty-handed. What happened?
Well, you know, first of all, I just want to say that, I mean, I must have spent, probably 2.5-3 hours talking with Trudy. And that's the one thing I want to say, too, about you're really getting a snapshot. We really try to weave a lot of stories that, I mean, and unfortunately, I wish it had been a 5,000-page book of all of the complete stories because, I mean, Trudy herself was just a wonderful woman to speak to, completely fascinating. But, you know, you're asking about going out, and this is really kind of the essence of Trudy. She's the real deal. I mean, she's just so genuine. And I could sense it from speaking with her. And she talks about how, you know, I guess it was her turn to go out and get the water. And so I was, you know, headed out with a pail to try to get water. And I guess she achieved it and found one of the hoses. And then basically, she probably had to cross halfway, you know, across the hill to find this water. But on her way back, she's, you know, hearing all these people sort of like, wow, is that water? What is, you know, can I have some, you know? And, you know, and I could tell by, you know, just by talking with Trudy that she could never turn anyone down. And so she proceeded to hand out water, you know, on her way back.
So.
And so by the time she reached, the light bus again and the rest of the band that was waiting for this water, the pail was empty. And so, you know, so they're saying, like, what happened? Well, where's the water? And as she, you know, talks about in the book, it's sort of like, you just couldn't deny anyone.
That's right.
You know, especially because they came, they had kids with them.
Mm-hmm.
And and as she said, you didn't want to. You didn't want to deny anyone. Mm-hmm. It wasn't the fact that you felt pressured. You just didn't want to. And I think that was the sense of Woodstock.
Now, listen to this sentence on page 95. They were all hot just sitting there, and when you have a chance to get somebody something that they need, you do it. We were all there to help each other. That, to me, is Woodstock. We certainly have lost that in this country today for a while. Anyway, it's going to come back, but my heavens, after the last 8 years of me first, and don't you object to anything I have to say, or you're going to be in trouble. Now, there were a series of obstacles placed by some of the citizens of Bethel who were not in favor of the festival, but they obviously had a change of heart later on about their feeling towards the Woodstock generation. When do you believe the many who were so opposed to it changed their attitude towards the festival and began helping them?
You mean during the festival itself?
Yeah, at the festival.
Well, I don't. Do you want to talk about that, Joanne?
I think it would have had. I don't know if it was. I think there was probably only a handful, maybe, that was so against it because there are so many stories about the neighbors. You know, we have stories in the book about different people at the camps that were in the area. You know, just handing out water to them or sandwiches or whatever that they had. I think that when the townspeople saw that they were just kids,
mm-hmm.
and you know I can't remember the one gentleman's name who he walked down to the pond and he was feeling that he was being stared at and all, but then by the time he came back, everybody's attitude had changed. I really don't think that it took long for the townspeople to, I don't know if
yeah, well, I think,
be happy
I think too
that they,
that they
were
started
there,
to
but,
recognize
you know,
that. They started to recognize that these were kids just like their own,
mm-hmm.
you know,
yeah.
and despite the fact, you know, and that's another thing too, that when people will go through the book, they will notice that there are a lot of stereotypes and a lot of myths, I think, that get broken. The whole idea that it's just all hippies and you know, there are a lot of middle class or whatever, you know, like non-counterculture kids. Many non-counterculture kids were at this festival who looked very much like their sons and daughters. And they were hungry, and they were tired, and wandering around, and are you not going to help them? And I think that's what they realized. And if, when you read through it, people like Shauna Na's Donnie York, I mean, he makes these admissions about, you know, sure, there was a lot of caring and sharing, and it was necessary, but there was a lot of external life support that kept that festival going.
Well,
they
were also
flown in. People, I mean, there were ladies auxiliaries making sandwiches in church basements and gathering them up and putting them on helicopters and flying them in because there were kids there just like their own.
Well, there were also a number of obstacles that the co-creators came up against as the event progressed. What do you believe were some of the worst problems, and how did they resolve them?
Oh, some
the worst problems.
I mean, there were a number of worst, like the water, the toilets, the you mentioned the food already.
Well, I think that as far as the food went, I think, you know, the hog farm had a lot to do with it. They were very ingenious or very resourceful. They, you know, they took the resources they had purchased, the oats and the barley and all the vegetables and all that, and learned how to make it stretch. It was definitely made available for those who wanted it. I mean, when I spoke with Wavy and I spoke with, you know, Janara and a number of people from the hog farm, Gene Nichols, who's also in the book, you know, their sentiment was that there was no need for anyone to go hungry. Mm-hmm. There were people who went hungry, but that was by their own choice.
By their own choice, yeah.
I like the store that made peanut butter and jelly sandwiches. Do you remember that? Vossamers or something like that?
Oh, the Vossamers.
Yeah. They made peanut butter and jelly sandwiches and gave
down
them
down at their store.
Yeah.
Their store was pretty much cleaned out, I believe, by Friday. They had to rearrange the store, so they had one of the doors where everybody went in and the other door on the other side of the store where the people would go out, so they would just go through, and they just basically bought everything. But they were handing out peanut butter and jelly sandwiches. They were making them upstairs where they lived and just sending them out. And he's pretty much known as the peanut butter and jelly guy in Bethel.
Well, when I was growing up, that was my favorite sandwich, and I keep thinking about them all the time.
Well, I'm sure it probably kept you know, a good peanut butter and jelly sandwich would have kept you going through the day.
That's right. They would have, yeah. Now, one of the greatest – oops, my producer is saying I better take a break here. Friends, we're about ready to award a copy of this book to our listeners here on 21st Century Radio. What is the book? Well, Joanne Haig and Brad Littleproud put together Woodstock, Peace, Music and Memories. It's published by Krause Publications, WoodstockPeace.com, 1-800-258-0929.
It's kind of about him. It's a song about you and me. I'm getting a bit old now. A song called My Generation.
People try to put us down.
About my generation.
Just because we
talking about my generation.
Things they do look awful.
Cold.
Topping the news this hour, an 8-year-old boy was rescued today by a really weird magic trick. Witnesses say the child was being threatened by an abusive school bully.
Scott had Timmy pinned down on the ground, and he was hitting him pretty hard.
Timmy started crying, and I told Matt somebody should do something.
Moments after the statement, an extremely pale, lanky street magician arrived on the scene. Police reports state the dexterous adult assessed the scene before deciding on the appropriate trick. The magician then covered the bully briefly with his long coat. What happened next is still under investigation.
The bully turned into a bunch of kittens.
Timmy was laughing. There were kittens all over him.
I wanted to take one home, but my sister's allergic.
The magician continued to wow onlookers with tricks using quarters, his left nostril, and the contents of a woman's purse. The young victim left the scene happy and unharmed.
Boy, you never see that happen.
That's because it doesn't. If you see abuse or neglect, learn what you can do from American Humane at BeHumane.org.
Hi, this is Steve Bailey, host of the Chesapeake Retirement Solutions Radio Hour. How do you choose a retirement community? We'll answer that question and others on the Chesapeake Retirement Solutions Radio Hour. Join us Sundays from 4 to 5 p.m. right here on Talk Radio, 680 WCBM.
UFOs are seen all over the world, but for some reason they seem particularly drawn to New York State. We'll hear some of the more spectacular witness accounts and why this area might be specially tuned for UFOs. Sunday night at 8, 21st Century Radio, Talk Radio 680 WCBM.
Zoe Hieronymus here. Do you ever wonder how biblical women dealt with stress? They experienced famine, war, lack of water, shortage of shelter, and inequality in their culture overall. But somehow, the seven prophetesses of Israel all rose to great leadership as a warrior, midwife, judge, royal queen, and more. Find out how you can be a queen. Kabbalah gives us all the tools for becoming the most we can be. Learn how to create peace in your life and love of others in your heart. Read my book, The Kabbalistic Teachings of the Female Prophets, The Seven Holy Women of Ancient Israel. Visit www.sevenholywomen.com. That's www.sevenholywomen.com, or visit amazon.com to get my book, The Kabbalistic Teachings of the Female Prophets.
I got to tell you, Ziggy and his wife, Orly Marley, who's going to be joining us again in a couple of weeks, just loved Zoe's book. Well, free books and prizes just for paying attention. Here's what you could win from the 21st Century Radio Quiz. The book, Woodstock, Peace, Music, and Memories, the 40th Anniversary by Brad Littleproud and Joanne Haig, courtesy of Krause Publications. Go to woodstockpeace.com. Plus, about a dozen other books and periodicals. Just be the first to answer this simple question. Our first guest last week was Dr. Mark Seifer. What was the name of his book that we reviewed? If you can tell us the name of the book that Dr. Mark Seifer discussed for an hour and a half last week, then you're going to be our winner, but you got to qualify, and here's how you do it. If you know the answer to this hour's quiz question on 21st Century Radio and you have not won from us in the last 60 days, call in now. 410-922-6680. That's 410-WCBM-680. First with the right answer wins. Prizes are available for you to pick up at the WCBM studios in Pikesville after Friday of this week. Winners have 60 days to pick up the prizes and must wait 60 days before winning another prize from 21st Century Radio. Good luck.
Hi, this is Remans Eric of The Doors, and you're listening to 21st Century Radio with Dr. Bob Hieronymus.
Well, we were standing on the curbs watching them come in last night, all the townspeople. Yeah. It was just like an army invading a town. Really? It's hard to believe.
Do you live here?
No, we're here for vacation.
Oh, are you? Are you having one?
We did up until last night. They kept us up for a while.
Who's they?
What I want to call them.
Is that what you call yourself?
No, thanks. I don't think
so. Is that what you call yourself, really?
Sure.
Why?
Because that's what everybody else calls us.
Well, why do you call yourself that for?
Because we admit it. Compared to everybody else, we're freaks.
I don't think you are. As long as you behave yourself, there's nothing wrong.
They seem to be having a good time.
I'm not putting bad connotations on the word freak, you know. I'm just...
the word freak itself had a bad connotation?
Well, it's whatever you think about it.
The last time we seen anything like this was at the Rose Bowl Parade last New Year's.
That's right.
Must have been a good Rose Bowl Parade. Well, welcome back to 21st Century Radio with our guests Joanne Haig and Brad Littleproud. Woodstock Peace, Music, and Memories. Krause Publications, woodstockpeace.com, 1-800-258-0929. Now, one of the greatest aspects of Woodstock was there wasn't any violence. But there were two deaths. What was responsible for those two deaths?
Well, I know I think one was a burst appendix, and then the second one was unfortunately that a young fellow was sleeping in a sleeping bag, and Saturday or Sunday, I can't recall. It was pretty muddy out, and then someone was driving a tractor with. It might have been a water tank behind it, and we sort of briefly described that in the book. And actually, one of our participants, our contributors, actually was a witness to it. This tractor was just I think they thought they were just driving over old, dirty sleeping bags, and unfortunately, there was this young fellow that was fast asleep, and he didn't fare too well when that tractor went over him. They tried to get, I think they tried to airlift him out, but he was already gone, which is really unfortunate.
Yes, I know. So, you know, this is extraordinary. If you put 100 or 200 people, give them a couple of cases of beer somewhere, you're going to have a war.
Oh, yeah.
That's, you know, this is the truth. Alcohol does it to you. It does something to people's egos that they have to pummel somebody else. Here you had close to a half a million people, and there were two deaths, and there weren't violent deaths. That is extraordinary, and it says so much about the consciousness of these individuals, of their giving and caring for each other. It was a different world then. Human beings were much different then, especially the younger people then, as we know of 1999 Woodstock. You know the difference.
That was something else.
Yeah,
but even then, you know, just to get on to 99, there's, you know, some of that is a little bit of hype as well about what would occur, even though, you know, when it did, you know, the violence that was there definitely overshadowed what, you know, anything that could possibly happen at the original Woodstock.
Yeah, I think that must have pleased the media a good deal. And I think that's the reason why they made so much of it. Well, here's one. I love this one. A 90-year-old Ben Leon, who ran a boat rental business on, I guess this is called Filipinis Pond, or also called Leon's Lake. What was it that he enjoyed most?
Do I take that, Joanne?
Oh, he was having a good time with the skinny dippers. His house sat up on the hill, so he was able to look down at the lake. So he had his own little movie going on all day long. He was renting the boats out, and
he had a pair of binoculars.
And that's where he spent his weekend.
And he didn't live too much longer after
that. No, he didn't. Unfortunately, I don't believe that it was even a month later.
I think it was 10 days.
When he passed away.
Yeah, he passed away, and they...
With a smile on his face.
That's so sad in a way, in the sense that, my God, he had to wait till he was 90 years old to see a group of people without clothes.
Oh, yes.
You know.
Well, and that was the lake that you see in behind the stage.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's Filipinis Pond.
Yeah.
And I'll tell you, I mean, I've been in Filipinis Pond. I fished in Filipinis Pond, and you know, you had to have been awful dirty and really wanting to get wet, awfully bad, go into Filipinis Pond.
Well, after all that rain, I mean, that's another aspect of it—the rain and the weather and all that kind of thing. Can you imagine if you take 100 people with one case of beer and put them out in the rain, in the mud, what they would do to each other?
Oh yes.
They would massacre each other. It's but that's, these people were extraordinary from that standpoint, and the media didn't pay any attention to that. Now, without Max Yasger's farm and his willingness to house the festival, it would not have happened. He is now so beloved that bumper stickers were created that wanted him to run for president. Will you tell us about this now legend, Max Yasger, and that has left the planet, unfortunately. He was, I think, just 54 when he died. Tell us a little bit.
1973 he passed away.
Yeah.
Yeah, he was a young man.
Oh, tell us.
You know, in other books they talk about, you know, and you know, Joanne and I, and I think that we need to sort of, you know, talk a little bit about the fact that, you know, people are saying, well, you know, you weren't at Woodstock, and here you are writing this book. But Joanne and I know a lot of people who were involved in Woodstock because of the work we had done around preserving the original site. So we almost feel like we were there. But there are lots of stories about Max, you know, and the fact that, I mean, he had a really bad heart, this guy, you know, and that, you know, when Michael Lang and those folks would talk to him, et cetera, he'd spend half his time in an oxygen tent in his house, and mm-hmm. you know, the story about him actually coming to the field, we didn't unfortunately capture it very well, you know, well in our book, but I guess on the Sunday, you know, his famous speech when he gets up on stage, well, I guess they saw him coming. They saw him coming. And, you know, and it's been the first time he'd visited the site since basically it has been turned into a mud pile,
mm-hmm.
you know, his beloved alfalfa field. And they really thought that Max was going to have a massive heart attack.
Yeah.
You know, and you know, and so they put him up on stage and said, you know, could you at least say something to the kids? You know, and I think that's really what created the legend of Max Yasker, was that he was so humbled, and you know, and they really thought, you know, that he was just going to lay into them about what they had done to his beloved alfalfa field, and he just got up there and just praised the kids.
Yeah, he did. That it's what I enjoy about this whole thing is that nobody tried to stop anybody from saying anything. That, you know, after living through the past 8 years, I mean, that stands out in my mind all the time. You know, they took a chance for him. He could have laid right into them and been a downer, but, you know, obviously it didn't turn out that way at all. Now, Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young did their first gig. Now, I keep forgetting that at Woodstock because they sounded so great, which launched their vastly successful career. What other groups profited by their performances at Woodstock?
Oh, many. You know, Santana.
Oh, Santana, yes.
And they admit to it. There are many who either say that it was the end of their career or it was the beginning of their career. Mm-hmm. And, you know, folks like Carlos Santana, well, the Who was already established, but, you know, new bands that nobody heard of, Joe Cocker.
Nobody heard of Joe Cocker?
Most people don't realize that Joe Cocker was an unknown.
Well, he certainly made his mark.
Exactly. Well, yeah. And, you know, people like that who went up, you know, even as much as people say, what the heck was Sha Na Na doing there?
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
It broke them. I mean, it made them big. It made them who they were. Now, there are others who, you know, have been perpetually, you know, been associated with Woodstock. And I guess, you know, as a career goes, I mean, that's a good thing. Although they, you know, some like Country Joe, et cetera, say that it has been somewhat limiting. I think that it's not a bad thing. I think that, you know, it keeps your notoriety alive.
What was amazing to me was my friend John Sebastian wasn't really scheduled to sing, but, you know, they had a problem. They had to get somebody up there on stage. And, of course, he being the kind of person he is, he went up there and of course, he forgot part of his song. And he made a huge hit, just a huge
Absolutely.
Hit. Not that he needed it for his career at that time, but this was the first time I think he was performing after the Lovin' Spoonful.
Right.
Right.
And, you know, Steve Boone of the Lovin' Spoonful is a bass player. We almost lived together for a while there. He's a good man. Well, so especially John, too. He's got a heart of gold. Well, look, we're almost out of time here. And when we've got a lot still to cover when we return in 21st Century Radio. There were Hendrix. We need to talk about that final act, Woodstock, and when Hendrix and the Star Spangled Banner, which I think, and he was only singing to about 30,000 people.
That's
at
right.
That time, and I know when we interviewed the people that did the film, there was really a conflict. They didn't want to show the Warner Brothers did not really want to show. That they wanted that cut back to 3 minutes, where it's about 16 minutes, because of the mud and everything else, and the field behind them.
Right.
And
yes.
I'm so glad that the producers won out. Oh, we got to take a break here. We'll be back with our guests, Brad Littleproud and Joanne Haig. Woodstock, Peace, Music, and Memories. Crowley Publications, WoodstockPeace.com. 1-800-258-0929.
Names and talk on Talk Radio 680 WCBM, Baltimore.
From ABC News, I'm Brad Wheelis. Will they ever complete the U.S. Open Golf Tournament?